Sorry, I'm a few minutes late.
That's all right.
I love hearing Microsoft nightmares. That's almost a redundancy.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of
Microsoft.
Yeah. And we're back.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Although I don't have a lot of good things to say about Apple's monopoly either.
I have become quite disenfranchised with that myself. Quick introduction. Welcome everyone to the Axis of Easy Salon number 24. Joining me from the Ottawa Valley, Jesse Hirsch. And from Hawaii, Charles Hugh Smith. I'm Mark Jeftovic in the west side of Toronto. And we are here. We were just about to start complaining about Apple's monopoly.
Go for it.
You know, when Apple first made the switch to putting like BSD underneath as the foundation of OS X, and I thought that was such a great move. And I think a lot of tech people thought that was a great move because it was the next best. It was like almost Linux. It was Unixy. It was under the hood. You could get a shell. And it just really was a genius move that just moved a whole segment of the market to them that otherwise wouldn't have gone that direction. But now it really does feel like they've got that take it or leave it mentality now. And then we're stuck in that position of what are the alternatives? I mean, I can't use Windows. I mean, we all have that Windows box kicking around somewhere that's just a bane on our existence. The Macs are increasingly more like a tech gulag than anything else. And I mean,
to your point, it was a great move that they went to BSD.
Mm-hmm.
They just needed more moves.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can't run a successful computer company on a random great thing every 5 to 10 years. You know, they had a lot of bad moves, in particular, the monopoly tendencies in the App Store and the rest of their platform. So you know, I think we still should celebrate and give them kudos for the BSD move while still lambasting them and making fun of them for all the other screw-ups.
Have you been following the Epic Games battle with Apple? Yes. About the App Store stuff?
Yes. I mean, it's interesting. It's early days because all of this comes back to antitrust. That was part of the timing of Epic's move. Was it coincided with the congressional antitrust hearings into Facebook and Google and Amazon, so on and so forth. But all of this is post-presidential election, right? All bets are off, whether economics, politics, technology, all of it, until after the election comes. But, you know, since I'm on the mic and we usually start these podcasts by saying what we'd like to talk about, I've been thinking a lot today about Facebook and the network state and the way in which Facebook governs itself that I wrote a newsletter issue for, but I kind of felt it was perfect material for the podcast. So that's one thing I'm bringing today. And the other is I got a couple of questions that come from our audience. And it kind of struck me that one of the incentives for encouraging folks to post comments on YouTube, to engage in us in any form, is I will grab some of those questions and bring them back to the podcast so that we really keep this conversation moving forward.
Surely. That's a great idea. Is that the Facebook's Big Stick Diplomacy article that you wrote earlier in the week?
No, I wrote it today. It comes out tomorrow, which for people watching the podcast is today.
Right.
Time is so relative. Lunchtime, doubly so. But nonetheless, I'll bring it up a little later in today's episode.
Okay, Charles, what's on your mind?
I'd like to get a little bit more on Big Mother, which was Jesse's piece, that tied a lot of very interesting, profound trends together, at least for me. And for my own work, I'd like to have you guys respond to my post where I was positing that consumption is dying for a lot of reasons, fundamentally because it just doesn't increase our well-being. And that's going to be a tough one for the permanent growth, you know, meme that the whole status quo depends on for its survival.
Right. Well, so there's a bit of overlap there because that was one of the ones of yours, Charles, that I had in mind for this week. I also really liked the politicization of everything. What can't be politicized doesn't exist, because that it's so pervasive now. It's just, there's no getting out of it. And I also liked the Empire of Uncertainty article, because that I had a bit of almost an epiphany while I was listening to a completely different podcast about, you know, I spend so much of my time walking around thinking like I have these big tectonic arcs in mind that I think are inevitable. And maybe this is going to sound silly coming from me at this stage of my life, but I just suddenly realized how nothing, like uninevitable everything was. Everything. And then I kind of almost realized how much all of us walk around thinking certain things are inevitable, and it was just like an edifice underneath my feet intellectually just kind of melted away. And that was all on the heels of reading your article. And for Jesse's part, I'll try to be quick through this. Your data privacy, individual versus collective, you're only as strong as or as smart as the people around you, because that a book I was listening to. And I wanted to find the reference before we came on, and I didn't have time today, but he was talking about how smart you are has very little bearing on how successful you will be in your life. He was talking from an investment and a prosperity point of view. He says, what's more important is how smart the community you live in is. How smart the people around you are has more of an effect on your material prospects than your own. That's a bitter pill to swallow for a lot of people, including me.
Although, allow me to briefly translate that in your context.
Yeah.
You're only as smart as the books you're reading.
Yeah, I suppose.
Because that's the community you've surrounded yourself with. Like, as a bibliophile, mm-hmm. which is very rare in our contemporary culture, you know, you in reading as voraciously as you do, it's your choice in authors that determines your success. It's your community of ideas that you've constructed using the medium of the book that is the equivalent of what he's describing in terms of the smart people around you, right? The latter just assumes that most people don't read, and therefore they are limited to the knowledge immediately around them because they don't know how to use the technology of the book to access knowledge that is beyond their corporal body and corporal community.
But you, granted to those points or to that point, but you still, you have to bring it back into the actual world, even if it's only virtual. Like, remember when we talked to Adam B. Levine and he said he never even met his co-founders in Tokenly, and they even did a funding round and he hadn't met them in person. But that's still people he was surrounded by, even to bring those ideas into the real world.
But I'm making the same argument, right? And I'm being a little coy. But what is the book except a pre-internet kind of internet that allows you to connect with an author by transcending space and time?
Right, right.
Right? You can't interact with them in the sense that you can't post a comment and they're going to reply. I do write in the margins of books all the time.
Oh, you should see my books. Yeah.
Right, no author has yet replied to my scrawling in the margins. But nonetheless, I think that there is a same virtual community that arises for a bibliophile as it does for a cryptophile who's active in cryptocurrency and Bitcoin.
Two very quick things on. So I guess I know I brought three things from each of you that I wanted to sort of throw out there. Your Zorin OS article, I know, was about an open source operating system, but I found the whole first half of it like metaphorical about everything you said about an OS applies to society at large.
Yeah.
And I remember a Jaron Lanier quote about exactly that, saying that what's in the operating system tends to ossify there, which is why it's very important in civilization and society to get that OS layer reasonably correct, because you're going to be stuck with it for a long time. And the last thing, and I'm going to let you in, Charles, in your Digital Shadow article, I understood what data sprawl was, but I think it needed a quick explanation to the person who's never been exposed to the term before of what that is. But let's bring in Charles now.
I'm only going to make a quick comment, and let's go back to data sprawl, because I think that's good. I was simply going to bring in something that Jesse said last salon about envy. And I think that's the that's one of the core drivers of being smart with the people around you, is when they're succeeding and just, you know, knocking it out of the park again and again, it's all like, man, my envy is totally sparked, and I'm gonna like up my game here, right? I mean, that's
absolutely
a jocular comment, but okay,
but relevant. I think in the academic sense, that's peer pressure.
Have you ever
If you're in an academic community and everyone around you is super smart, you feel a lot of pressure to perform.
I once heard of a study that found that your happiness can be measured by how wealthy you are compared to your brother-in-law. So the happier you were, the better off you were than your brother-in-law.
So let's hope that your brother-in-law isn't like one of those MD, PhD, concert violinist types. Or I think you're right, though, Mark. That's the idea that we only compare our prosperity and well-being to those in our immediate circle, more or less. You know, somebody can be a billionaire, and if we don't know them, we don't care.
I don't know about that, though. In this today's society, where everything is virtualized and disintermediated, like, I walk around sometimes struggling with feelings of being a loser, for example, on a bad day, and someone's like, well, why do you feel like you're a loser? It's like, well, you know, I never got my company as big as, you know, Mark Zuckerberg. Or so you find yourself comparing yourself to the most successful people on the planet, and all you really set out to do was to build a neighborhood ISP or a company that just serves a very small set of people. But you have this mythology in today's world: if you're not number one, you're a loser. You know, the old, who was the guy who ran GE? He just died recently. Jack Welch. If you can't be number one or two in the field, you shouldn't even get out of bed. Don't even come in. You know, you got to be one or two, or you're a complete loser.
But that was the mythology of 20, 30, 40 years ago. I think the mythology of today is a little different, in that the logic is still the same, that only the number one or number two matter. But the mythology has created the phenomenon of the long tail, that it lets everyone believe that they have a chance to be number one and number two, because it wants them to keep toiling away. It wants them to keep working in spite of the fact that they don't matter. So I've got a little rap that I sort of use that addresses this, which is that we live in a neo-feudal society where celebrity is the aristocracy, because they command the scarce resource, which is attention. And that anyone who can command attention can translate that attention into actual economic capital, as the Kardashians have done quite brilliantly, and the D'Amelio clan is currently doing via TikTok. But it speaks to how celebrity is this kind of aristocracy, precisely because there's only a limited amount of them. And yet we live through their lives. Today, for example, I'm not going to name them, but there was a celebrity couple who tragically had a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so their news is everywhere. And my first reaction was to feel empathy for them, not because of the miscarriage, but because everyone knew they had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
But then I thought, but wait a minute, their power and their wealth is based upon all of us knowing that they had a miscarriage. So as unpleasant as that might be for them, it is their profit motive. And it becomes a very weird paradox between, you know, the celebrity's desire for attention and the prison that is attention, and it's the like prison that is celebrity.
It's like you put up your hand for this, and now you can't really plead for some privacy, because your entire platform is built on putting yourself out there.
But I think it's even worse. I think it's a Hunger Games analogy, where, you know, you want to be selected because you want to win. But second place is death, right? And it's one of those like crazy hopes of I could do it, when in reality everybody loses their liberty, their sense of well-being, their sanity, their. So this is a good opportunity to bring in one question off of YouTube, which was from Jeff Snyder, and Jeff wanted to know the cultural dynamics. Like, he sort of mentioned how we talk a lot about the collapse of civilization, and you know, he sort of wondered if there was a correlation between both the superhero mythology, which is the idea that someone's going to save us, with the kind of zombie and the end of the world pop culture, which his argument, which I thought was pretty clever, was that perhaps one of the purposes of the eschatology pop culture, which is the end of the world pop culture, is it makes us think that the end of the world is something that's not happening right now. That a society collapsing is not the one that we're seeing. It's something much worse. It's something much more embellished. It's something much more crazy. And it's a distraction. It's a sleight of hand. In Hollywood, creating this exaggerated scene of civilization collapse, none of us can recognize that our civilization is collapsing right now. Which is something we talk about often, that, you know, we keep thinking, oh, maybe it'll happen, when in fact it's already happening. We're just struggling to notice and struggling to pay attention.
Charles, can I jump in very quickly ahead of you?
Please. No, please do.
So there's two things I'll say to that. One is I struggle with pessimism versus optimism. So sometimes I'm very much like, this is the end of the world as we know it, and it can't feel any other way. And to that end, I was listening to the latest Grant Williams podcast this morning. He's so witty, the names of his podcasts. So he's one podcast, and there was the one I was listening to this morning, is called The Super Terrific Happy Hour. and they talk about the collapse of the global financial system. And he made the exact point that you made, which is currency systems or financial systems, global financial systems collapse historically all the time. So we're 50 years into this one. Why should it be any surprise to anybody if it's collapsing? But if a global financial system is in collapse and it doesn't feel like this, then I don't know what else it could possibly feel like. And the metaphor that's been recurring in my mind lately, well, not lately, for months now, and I don't know if I've ever brought it up in here, is to your point, Jesse, I was saying to somebody this morning, we won't talk about the real candidates, but my fantasy presidential election ticket was Tulsi Gabbard versus Rand Paul. And obviously that's not going to happen, but maybe in a parallel universe, the alternate universe thing. And I suddenly, I've had this reoccurring notion in my mind that somewhere there's a normal universe where sanity is prevailing, and we're the bizarroverse to that place. So we're in the bizarroverse. We're the alternative reality where everything is upside down and crazy and nutso. And we think that this is normal and this is what normalcy feels like. And the quick thing is the optimism side of things. You read books like The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley and some of the other books like Arthur Herman's The Idea of Collapse in Western Civilization. And you think, if you look at all this in historical perspectives, maybe what we're going through is just your standard issue, creative destruction, fourth turning, switching from one regime to another, which is a very painful process, but not the end of the world as we know it, just an end of a regime as we know it. And there's a bit of a difference there.
And if it was a new regime coming that we liked, that was what would make it optimistic. Sorry, yes. Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, we've been elbowing you out of the conversation.
We'll come back to that.
Well, you guys have blocked the key, so I'm going to just take a three-pointer. You know, I'm just going to let it go from 30 feet, see if it drops. That's, you know, sorry for the basketball analogy, but if you can't drive for the hoop, then you just, you know, let it go. No, I think this is a great topic, and thank the person that brought it up, because to tie in both your comments, the superhero thing and the zombie thing are interesting, because to me, they they're the meta text to both of those is the decline or the decay of competence. So we don't really have a system that's competent, so we need superheroes. And of course, superheroes also have a they have a cultural foundation in comic books, and so you know that was kind of an easy play for mass media. But I think we talk about the decay of institutions, and what we're really talking about to some degree is institutions are the wrong size, they're the wrong type of organization. But we're also, I think, noticing the collapse in the real world. The present is a decline in competence, so that stuff just doesn't work because people don't know how, and the organization that they're that can't function at the scale that it's supposed to or at the level of competence. So that's one thought. And in terms of Mark, your comment about fourth turnings and like the new regime, I guess the thing is it a meet the new boss same as the old boss change, or is it the barbarians, and they're not really interested in recognizing all the wealth and whatever we can turn, you know, it's like they're the foundation of our well-being has eroded regardless of the new who's running or not running the new regime. So superhero saves us, but if we can't be saved, then what?
Well, and I think your point about barbarians is, you know, is the new regime of the same culture, or is the new regime of such a completely different culture that it has no interest in our culture, and therefore the end of the world is the end of our culture, not so much the end of the world as we know it. And I think based on the culture wars, there's reason that either side would sort of believe that. But Charles, let me use that as a hook to ask you a follow-up question that came from a different member of our audience, our good buddy Mike in Santa Fe. And Mike and I have been emailing, and Mike, we ended up talking about Greece. And Mike is a longtime reader of yours, Charles, and was sort of referencing some of the stuff you had written about the economic crisis that happened in Greece a few years ago. And it sort of reminded me that was a real canary in the coal mine. That, you know, what we saw in Greece was a real kind of preface or foreshadow to kind of what we're seeing now. I'm curious if you agree. Do you think that both the way in which the Greece economy collapsed and the response to it, do you think that the United States is on a similar track? Do you think the global economy is on a similar track? Is there an analogy to be made in terms of what happened to the Greek economy and what happened to the Greek political system, political establishment, in terms of what we're potentially seeing around the world today?
Well, Mark, I'm sure you've got an opinion on that. Let me just kick it off. Thank you very much for the question, Jesse and Mike. You know, the thing with Greece is we actually had a good friend who was Greek, and he was had worked in Europe and America, but his family was in Greece, and so he followed things closely. So we actually had a legitimate source in the sense we weren't just reading third-hand accounts. What struck me about Greece that I think does apply to the U.S. and the global economy is people in Greece were afraid of ditching the euro, because the euro had allowed them to overborrow. In other words, because they could borrow in a currency that was fundamentally, essentially backed by Germany and Northern Europe, then they could borrow huge amounts of money that they would never have qualified for with their own currency. So they were too fearful to let go of that and be on their own. And so they basically accepted what you've called, you know, a kind of financial neo-feudalism. They accepted serfdom because it was, in their mind, superior to being on their own. And again, this is the end of empire kind of stuff, because that's exactly what happened in the Roman era. A lot of people went and attached themselves to a monastery, not as a monk, because that was a select group, but as a peasant or serf who, you know, tended the fields owned by the monastery, and they had the protection of the monastery. So I think that Greece is a model. It was a canary in the coal mine, and people are terrified of letting go of anything that lets them borrow more money than they're really qualified for, because that's what everybody's living on.
Interesting.
Mark?
Well, I don't know if I can comment too intelligently on it because I was never immersed in that situation, and the underlying situation between the euro and what's going on in the world today, we're not the same. But what is kind of an apples to apples comparison is that the system reached a breaking point where the economically solvent were unwilling to continue to finance the economically overleveraged. So it's basically the end of a debt super cycle, kind of a dynamic playing out. And what happens when that plays out, there's an enormous amount of will to keep the system on the tracks, that you'll do anything, say anything, try any trick to make it work and keep going, because the consequences of it not keeping going are unthinkable. And I think the parallel to today is we're in a similar kind of a dynamic where we're stuck at the zero bound on the interest rates. There's too much debt in the world. Now we've had this pandemic, and so we can't slow down on the fiscal support, because it's just trying to slam the brakes on this from a economic solvency point of view is an unthinkable scenario. I think I've mentioned it before. 2008 was kind of our last chance to say, let's not paint ourselves into a corner, and we went ahead and did so. So I don't know if that makes much sense, but I think that's the dynamic of just, we had a microcosm of like, this is what it looks like when a system, just an economic system, becomes unglued, and then this is how you try to glue it back together.
Although, I mean, the analogy we hit last episode or the episode before was there are no brakes any longer. It's a matter of keeping the vehicle on the mountain.
Yeah.
And it is a mountain because it's gotten so high. It's done everything it could to climb and climb and climb. But, you know, this is why everyone's sort of leaning on one side, hoping that it'll keep the gravity at play. But that actually ties to Mike's other question for you, Mark, which I thought was really interesting and may seem like a different subject, but I actually think it's a perfect tie-in. And that's, why is it so difficult to convict financial fraud and combat the most heinous aspects of the what you've sort of described in the past, the inability to fail, or the way in which those closest to the spigot or those closest to the money are able to get by with not just fraud, but broken business models and complete dishonesty, when the technology exists to detect almost everything?
Yeah.
And it speaks to a kind of paradox where we're in this society, like, all societies have known that there's corruption. All societies have known that there's elites who are using the levers of power to serve their own self-interest. But it seems, you know, whether you call it the WikiLeaks era or the post-Snowden era, that there is a kind of everybody knows to our current world. And yet, why is that not resulting in either greater outrage in terms of those financial injustices or actual demands for that financial justice?
I really wish I knew the answer to that question. I mean, I don't want to just dismiss it as, well, people in the SEC get jobs in the private sector when they leave, and so it's a revolving door and everyone has a vested interest in going along to get along. It could be that simple.
Let me just point out that I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
And to tie it back to something we discussed earlier in this episode, that's not a conspiracy, that's a culture.
Yes.
And it's the culture that enables the don't rock the boat and everybody knows everybody, so we're all gonna work along, get along to work along. And I think that's the nuance that a lot of people, especially outsiders, fail to see. That there is a kind of, because the media works the same way. Everyone's friends.
Yeah.
And because everyone's friends, they're not going to piss each other off, when really what we'd prefer is they piss each other off.
And sometimes I think that entire institutions that ostensibly serve to protect the public were merely theater to project the illusion that it's there to protect the public, for a couple of reasons. One could be they're not really there to protect the public because now the system is so rotten underneath that if you pull on a thread, and you don't know what's going to come out of it. I mean, you look at the Wirecard fraud in Germany, and it's just really bringing a whole bunch of roosters home and opened a huge can of worms, and that's one company. And the other thing, I just lost my train of thought. The other thing was that it's gone. I had it, and it's gone. I'm sorry.
That's all right. We'll come back to it.
Yeah, if I think of it, I'll stick up my hand. But
I think to your point that this is the killer problem, right? And it is the type of thing that the you know, whether it's DeFi or whether it's just the distributed technology that I think...
I remembered it.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. There was a 60 Minutes did a piece a bunch of years ago about how congressmen can legally insider trade. Okay, and then the Congress passed, I can't remember the name of it. It was like congressmen can't trade on Insider Information Act because there's a lot of outrage. But then about 90 days or 180 days later, they changed one tiny little paragraph in the act that completely changed the dynamic of the way that these insider trades had to be reported, so that the narrative or the mythology of the act lives on, but the implementation of the act to actually enforce it is almost completely gutted. And so that sort of reinforces my belief that perhaps the entire SEC and some, you know, other organizations in a similar boat exist only to preserve the status quo and to foster this illusion of looking out for it.
Although, to be clear, it's not an illusion to them. Like, those who drink the Kool-Aid genuinely believe. It's an illusion to us because we don't drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where the psychology can be so powerful for the people on the inside, is that they really believe the myth. And in believing the myth, it gives them a sense of purpose. It gives them even a sense of dignity. And it's what makes these systems strong. But with that said, and you know, I'll shut up because I want to come back to this in a bit. It's the difference between the nation state and the network state. That the nation state requires the mythology to maintain the status quo. The network state does not. And I'll elaborate on that in a bit, but we've talked enough. Charles?
Well, let me just wrap up that topic with, Jesse, you're not a conspiracy, it's a culture. I think that really does explain, like, Bernie Madoff. You know, there was somebody who, a whistleblower, repeatedly, I think it was 8 years before the thing finally broke, or 7 years. I mean, the guy was had notified all the proper authorities that this was not possible. You know, it was a fraud. And he was completely ignored. And so you say, well, was it a conspiracy? No, it was just the culture of, hey, here's a guy who's really rich in New York City. He's all of his clients are rich and powerful, so are we going to, like, upset the boat and maybe have something at the piano fall on us? No. Right, because that's the culture. And I want to bring up real quickly one of Mark's points from, like, I think it was Mark, from a previous salon, where what we incentivize and reward now is not people performing the purpose of the institution. We reward them for navigating the bureaucracy of the institution. And I think, again, I'll bring up one more Roman thing. At the end, and Jesse, this, I think of McLuhan's, you know, what you brought in about McLuhan about this, even it applies to Rome. There's nobody in the legion. There's no soldiers, there's nothing. But there's somebody submitting pay chits to the central command, you know? And it's like, well, there's no reporting. And so that guy mastered, or, you know, the bureaucracy, but there's actually no there's no army at the end of that bureaucratic chain. It's gone. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I feel we're at.
It's like the civilization equivalent of broken telephone.
Yes.
And well, I don't even know if I want to name names of who I think the modern day Madoff story is, or the, you know, the fraud that's just dying to be detected. But, you know, Tesla. Sorry.
All right. Well, Jesse, you had a good meme there, I mean, a good narrative or topic. Why don't you go back to that?
Well, there's two, and I'll tie them together. I mean, you guys both brought up the data sprawl, and the data sprawl is this idea that, you know, we leave breadcrumbs, digital breadcrumbs behind everywhere we go. And for the most part, we don't think about it. Another way to think about this is a digital shadow. But data sprawl describes a digital shadow that's sticky. So that, you know, normal shadow follows you around. But a digital shadow is like this trail you leave, every website, every click, every social media account. And the irony is that with people staying at home more, their data is sprawling even more so because they're looking at more websites. They're creating logins. They're engaging. They're providing data to different services. So it's partly thinking about, say, information pollution in an ecosystem, that there's sort of always information leaking from us as we do things. And that maybe there's a benefit to having either greater awareness of one's data sprawl or greater control of one's data sprawl, which then leads me to Facebook, because of course Facebook is the great suburbs in the sky that, like an urban sprawl, continues to extend its tentacles everywhere. And so I kind of, you know, today we're recording this on October 1st. And so yesterday on September 30th, again, I'm being facetious when I say this, but it made me wonder, if we live in a network state, how does a coup d'etat happen in a network state? Because I suspect, and again, I'm being facetious and kind of playful here, that Facebook was subject to a coup d'etat on September 30th and October 1st, 2020. It was not a successful coup d'etat, but the plotters have not given up in that they've named themselves publicly as the real Facebook Oversight Committee. Now, a little technical sounding name to our point about navigating bureaucracy, but a little background. In 2019, I think it was the spring of 2019, Mark Zuckerberg announced that he was going to create a Supreme Court of Facebook. Because, of course, Mark, Chairman Mark, is the dictator of all Facebook, because he has the controlling shareholder and the chairman and CEO has the arbitrary ability to do pretty much whatever he wants with the platform, a society of now roughly 2.6 billion people. So a lot of people have been saying, we don't want a dictatorship. We want someone else to make decisions. So about a year and a half ago, Zuckerberg says, I'm going to form a Supreme Court, a content oversight committee that will have ultimate jurisdiction and decision over contentious moderation issues and policies.
I remember that.
Here we are, October 2020. It still doesn't exist. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, Facebook is playing a very influential role in the U.S. election. There should be some oversight. If there was ever a job for a Facebook Supreme Court, now is the time. And to give Facebook credit, the reason it's taken them a year and a half is they don't want to mess it up. A Supreme Court, these are very powerful things. Who gets to be on that Supreme Court is a very contentious, powerful thing. Now, ironically, one of the main leaders on the Facebook side in doing this is Nick Clegg, who is the former British politician, part of the Brexit kind of world. Long story short, a group of people, self-appointed, largely the most known Facebook critics in the world, Roger McNamee, Shoshana Zuboff, a Guardian reporter, a bunch of people who just ran a Facebook boycott that was successful a couple of months ago, they have declared themselves the Oversight Committee. The real Oversight Committee is what they call themselves. They're issuing demands to Facebook. They've come up and they've said, we will be the Supreme Court. And it struck me that in a network state, you don't need to take out the center. Like in a nation state, a coup d'etat has to occupy parliament, seize the army, take control of communications. But in a network state, there is no center. You don't have to actually occupy anything. You just have to claim authority, claim legitimacy. And if people give you that legitimacy, well, then all of a sudden you're in power. Now, this real committee who do they have as their ally? Well, the legacy media. Because the legacy media are terrified of Facebook. So NBC helped launch this attempted coup d'etat with a huge publicity campaign promoting this real oversight committee. So again, while they didn't succeed today, they are still going to persist. And it kind of made me think in a comical way, could someone just stand up and say, we will govern Facebook. We are the ruling committee, the workers' Soviet of Facebook, and we demand power. Chairman Mark, give us the keys. And if society demands that they do so, again, I'm being facetious.
No, I know. Struck me as but an interesting you're not that far off if you had a faction inside the belly of the beast who had the root passwords and the network logons, and they decided to throw in, then yes, that's what a coup d'etat may look like in the 21st century. That group, I know that group that you're talking about, but I can't remember the name of that group. Because they have that the British one, Nick Clegg and Shoshana Zuboff and stuff, they have
Nick Clegg is Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Nick Clegg, it's Facebook's global director of public policy.
But the Shoshana Zuboff, she authored Surveillance
she's
Capitalism.
She's an individual.
But
she's not a group.
Okay, so maybe I'm confused with a group that exists that's some sort of like independent media oversight center, and they're based out of England, and I thought maybe that's who you were talking about.
No, there are many, and there are, and this is just, imagine that the cool kids at school, the ones in the courtyard smoking cigarettes, better looking, think they're smarter than everybody, they just decided they were going to take over the school.
Yeah.
And rather than go occupy the principal's office, they just said, no, school happens in the courtyard now. Anyone who wants to be cool and get 1,000 followers on Instagram, they're going to come to us in the courtyard and do what we tell them. And then everyone decides to leave the school and go hang out in the courtyard. And the principal's stuck in his office going, wait a minute, what just happened? Right? And I say that in that there are thousands of critics of Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Why this group? Why these people? Because they're seizing power. Because they're the Bolsheviks who just happened to decide we are going to speak on behalf of the Soviet, and we are the ones who are going to say what's up. And because the legacy media is their ally, they will be amplified in a way that, but you know, they also have, because they're all well known, they've all got lots of followers on social media as well. So I just think it's a fascinating political power play.
It's Charles, I'll let you in one sec. It's almost it's the inverse. We've talked about this book before, Coup d'Etat, A Practical Handbook by Edward Litwack. I think you mentioned another book of his, Charles, in the previous thing called Hypercapitalism. But in that book, he said you cannot successfully stage a coup d'etat unless you have a power outside of the nation state you're overthrowing who's going to back you. And in the network state, to throw a coup d'etat, you're going to have a power inside the network state who's going to back you, that's going to help you. Just, you know, suddenly you flip a few switches and it's like, yeah, we're in charge now and we take control.
And in defense of my French friends, the last T is silent.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I think you make an excellent point about having an outside power. And just to kind of further the discussion on what's the difference between a network state and a nation state. Well, the network state does depend on revenues, but not, you know, the revenues from engagement, not from taxes, right? So where is the power in a network state? Well, there's lots of nodes of power, right? But one of them is, who's funding these big social media platforms, right? Because it's like part of their power is not just their reach, but they have a lot of money. So if you could control, like people were, I think, attempting to do with the boycott, if you can gain control of their funding or their revenue stream, then that would be the equivalent, Mark, of having, say, the U.S. recognize your coup d'état in your nation. So it's interesting to analyze where are the power centers in the network state outside of the network itself.
And it kind of explains why Facebook really would like to have their own currency. I mean, they started with Libra, and that Libra flopped because nation states reacted viscerally to it for reasons we've explored here before. But I don't know if a lot of people know that Libra is being quietly rebranded as Novi, I think it's called, and they haven't given up on this idea. And if you control your own currency, then it's harder for some force that's not with the program to seize control of your revenue streams. It is very different. It's a different landscape, it's a different world, and it's going to create a whole different set of dynamics.
And to your point, I'd push back a bit and say it didn't flop, it stumbled. Because they're still going, and I don't think anything's going to stop them because of the necessity of a currency if you're going to be what they want to be.
Yeah, actually, I didn't even realize I said flop, because that isn't really how I look at it, so.
No, and it speaks to that, to bring it back to this notion of civilization, that, you know, what the myth of the Cold War is that it ended when the Berlin Wall fell. But in reality, eras overlap, right? The era of the nation state and the era of the network state will overlap by decades, may overlap by centuries.
Yeah.
And I think we take for granted that these types of societies can coexist simultaneously. That I think all three of us largely live in a network state, in that neither of us really respect the nation state that much. And we certainly don't look to the nation state for guidance or for prosperity. But instead, to bring it back to this idea of how smart you are or how stupid you are, it comes down to your network. And we're all the types of people who construct, facilitate, participate in networks that we seek to make us stronger, happier, smarter, with greater prosperity. And I think that speaks to those of us who are residents of network states, who perhaps resent the power and influence the nation state may have over us, but we give no credence, we give no time, we reluctantly give taxes, but I would say most of our money, most of our resources goes towards networks, and they are the beneficiaries of our activities.
Yeah, let me toss in two power centers that are based in the material world that will not go away, and I think they're what make what I call the empire of uncertainty. The topology of that empire makes it's quite unpredictable. Is that one is energy. So if Facebook really wants to maintain power, they're going to have like they're going to have to invent and control the little fusion, you know, generators or something, because if the energy system is disrupted, then people will go hungry, and then they're not going to care so much about things that we think they care about now. And so that's a real world thing. And the other thing is the military, because I'd say globally, the large, well-established militaries have an intense existential need to maintain their competence. And so I wouldn't write them off as defective as the political nation state, because I could imagine a situation where the helicopters land in Palo Alto, and Mark Zuckerberg and the rest of the board are handcuffed and taken away for crimes unmentioned, and they disappear. And it's like, well, guess what? They became an obstruction. And so force still has a role, you know, and we have to be wary of that.
Although, in full agreement, allow me to pivot a little. If Facebook is one quarter of what we think it is, then Chairman Mark would have at least a couple of months, if not more, advance notice that such an action was being contemplated against him. and would have the resources and the wherewithal to build a military force of his own that would be able to repel such an attempted abduction.
We would be seriously into the jackpot Neal Stephenson snow crash for the world to get to a point where that militarization were to occur.
And you heard it here first on Access and Easy. Heard it here as first. Ludicrous as it may sound, we read books, or at least they read books, but I did read Snow Crash, and I'll tell you, whoa.
Should be mandatory reading. I'll say two other quick things to Charles'
points.
Come
on, if it's mandatory reading, you know that people like you and I wouldn't read it.
Yeah, I know. On the energy thing, it reminded me of how, if you look throughout history, how it's sort of necessity is the mother of invention, and even with that, the profit motive, because that will move things forward in a way that no government policy will. And I'm thinking of an example of when I first became exposed to the ideas of like Amory Lovins. I was used to listen to this documentary series called Bioengineers or something like that on public radio.
Bioengineers,
yes.
They're great. They're
what was his name? Neil Harvey or something like that?
I couldn't tell you.
Great
the
show.
The Bioengineer movement's really spread and gotten large. But yes, the Bioengineers radio show, which we would have heard on CIUT.
Correct. University of Toronto fantastic. Radio. Yeah. And so in one of the speeches on that show, and I'll see if I can find that for the show notes page, Lovins just jokes off the top. He's talking about radical energy efficiency, but he was talking about the whales and how the world moved from whale oil to kerosene, and he just kind of finished it off with a riff. Is like, and thus the whales were saved by profit maximizing capitalists, right? And he was joking, but he was right. And so when Charles said energy is you can't paper over energy, he's right. And so I think about, never mind what's a politically correct power source, what is an economically viable power source? And so, I mean, personally, I've always had this soft spot for like thorium energy, because I regard it as like a safe nuclear, but no, there's no political buy-in. I think Andrew Yang was the only candidate this year who even mentioned it. But imagine if suddenly like Facebook's and Google's are saying, well, you know what, we're going to build our own thorium reactors because we have the money to do it, and now we have our own power source. And so this kind of like radical energy transformation starts to happen privately, completely based on economic return instead of what's politically correct and that sort of thing.
But let me stitch together a few threads, although take a brief moment to say, let's banish the word political correctness because it's empty and meaningless.
Okay, can I just say one thing before I turn you loose and then I'm done for the whole episode?
Okay, go.
The three of us, what the three of us have that give us the ability to stitch these kinds of ideas together is that we have an awareness of history. And I think what's missing today is, along with that competence, is that awareness of history, because people think that whatever's happening now is all there is. And they don't understand that we've been through a few hundred iterations of this in various orders of intensity and succession. But anyhow, go ahead, Charles.
So,
Jesse.
No,
when I said
no
Charles.
No problem. It's just now I want to respond to that. I don't disagree with anything you said, but I feel that you just opened up a whole new barn door. That's a lot of animals in there that we need to go and say hi to. So let me just take a deep breath and try to bring it back to what I was going to say, which was to bring back Charles's point about consumption and declining consumption and our recurring theme around decentralization and energy. Because one of the natures of energy, of course, is it usually requires scale. It usually is enables centralization. And what I think is the real threat to capitalism or Western civilization is self-sufficiency, is self-reliance, is the homesteader movement, is the off-the-grid movement. Because, you know, a couple episodes ago, Mark, you were joking about how you felt that there was nothing you could do for yourself because you live in a city and there's all these services, there's all these professionals who can do it for you. And what strikes me is that one of the impacts of the pandemic, combined with the knowledge networks that are the internet, is people are getting back into repair. People are figuring out how to fix their home. People are figuring out how to fix their vehicles. People are figuring out how to bake, how to sew, how to do all these things for themselves, all of which is the opposite of consumption. That consumption is based on helplessness. It's based on the consumer being seduced by convenience and being thoroughly helpless and therefore a serf, because they got to go out and do a crappy job so they could be able to buy, like, all, anyway, I could go on, except to say, I think there is a huge trend of people who want to do things for themselves, who want to be in control, who want to have autonomy, who want the fulfillment and the dignity that comes from doing things yourself. It's often harder, it's often slower, it's often way less convenient, but it's anti-consumerist. And I think that is an economic threat, because there will be far less consumption, still economic activity, right? Most of the people who are building on their own are producers. They're making stuff, they want to sell stuff. So you still have market economies, you still have people doing things, but it's not the consumer capitalism that we've seen for the last several decades. I think that's where we're moving out of. And I think that is a really big seismic shift. And I think energy should be part of that, right? I think there needs to be a way in which people can become energy self-sufficient, whether that's through solar. And look, I hear what you're saying about Tesla. I get it. I'm Tesla agnostic right now. But I do hope that they enable a greater battery revolution. And I am hoping that they help lower the cost of batteries and make batteries more accessible, because that's a key element of the distributed energy scenario, where, you know, if I could store energy more so that on good days I'm collecting more than I need, and on bad days I've got it in my battery banks, that's where I think we get to the type of decentralized world where people are not so much consumers, but they are producers, they're self-sufficient, and they've got their own energy. That's where I think we start entering the kind of democratic society that, to your point, the three of us have a real Venn diagram overlap in terms of what we think would be the better society that our technology and our knowledge is enabling.
And I will just add something that Mark and I have often brought up, and Jesse, you've asked questions about it, which is debt, right? In other words, part of that consumerist helplessness that you've described has been completely enabled by debt. You know, like, you know, instead of having to figure out how to change the oil in your car yourself, you just put the $90 on a credit card and on, right? And so once, if the debt sort of empire collapses and people have to live off their own earnings or, you know, productivity, that will be a huge encouragement to the trends you described so aptly.
I think, to your point, Jesse, over the course of the lockdown, I, for one, as an all thumbs guy who can't put a picture in the wall, have actually been doing more home repairs than I've ever done in my life. And you're right. YouTube is actually a gold mine resource for that, for just finding, like, how do you do this and how do you fix this appliance and stuff like that. And just a quick thing about, I'm not disagreeing with you about what you said about Tesla, but I think all of that battery innovation and stuff is coming out of Toshiba, and I think Tesla just buys the batteries from them and just kind of puts a ridiculous car around it and sells it at a loss. But I'm being facetious too, but I think
I think that's a valid point, that part of what one of the lessons of this pandemic is we need more transparent supply chains, mm-hmm. so that we can't have some big braggart, some big showman sort of take credit for innovation that should be more accessible but isn't, because maybe they've monopolized it through contracting, right? Or have bought up the global supply and cornered the market.
Yeah. So I think that might be a good,
allow me to say one last thing in ending. So mm-hmm. I, you know, with my animals here on the farm, I like cultivating the reputation as the treat man, mm-hmm. right? Because my partner, Jeanette, she's the one who takes care of them. But I like it when I come out that all the animals rush to me. And so with the chickens, I usually carry like a big case of sunflower seeds and I shake them around. So we have this one rooster named Howard Zinn. And Howard Zinn is so obsessed with me that he will follow me like into the next pasture waiting to see if there could be sunflower seeds. So you're right. History is very important, but you got to read a diverse set of history, as Howard Zinn would tell us, especially if you want to follow the guy with the sunflower seeds. So post a comment below. We may read it in the future episode in terms of fostering greater audience interactive and participation. And don't forget the coup d'etat with the algorithms. Be sure to hit that thumbs up button and to subscribe and share this with all your comrades and frenemies.
And yeah, you can leave the comment either on the YouTube channel or on the accessofeasy.com, where we post all these episodes, and also all the show notes with all the things we talk about, where we can, the references get linked to on the accessofeasy.com page. Tell all your friends, and we'll see you all next week.
Well, and if you do want to post a comment via a plane doing smoke signals in southern Etobicoke,
yeah.
If you tweet Mark first, he'll be sure to read that comment.
Yes. Yeah. All right. We'll see you guys next week.
All right. And kudos on getting Ben on the program.
Yes. Ben Hunt on October 15th will be our guest on Access of Easy. So tune in for that.